I'm sure you'll agree with me on this. If there is one overused word in a startup world, it's the word growth. Everyone's talking about it. Everyone's probably asking you about it all the time too, and they expect the answer to be in double digits at least, right? Hell, people ask me about my business growth, knowing full well that I'm a solo consultant and can really work with a handful of clients at a time. It's crazy. But what if you deliberately said no to all that? Could you even have a successful startup without focusing on achieving that ridiculously fast growth? Well, yes, you can. In fact, that's exactly what my guest in this episode, Steve McLeod from Future Upvote, has been doing from the start. Steve has an incredibly interesting story, one of deliberately choosing slow growth to build a sustainable and low-stress business. It's fascinating, and so without any further ado, here's the interview. We're running. Hey, Steve, how's things?
Good, thanks. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Thank you so much for joining. Listen, I thought I'm going to do something cheeky to start with. So I know from your show that you, at least you used to do this, you used to send your guests a checklist that would list, okay, how to prepare for the interview, which is a brilliant idea. And one of the items is prepare a short, kind of your short bio and your product description. So I'm going to check how well you follow your own request. So off you go.
Okay, I'm the founder of Future Upvote. Future Upvote is a B2B SaaS, if we're going to use inside terminology. I'm assuming everybody listening knows about MRR and ACVs and LTVs, yeah, and all the three-letter acronyms. Feature Upvote lets your customers openly suggest and upvote ideas to improve your product. That gives you the data you need to make better product decisions, leading to happy customers and better income, hopefully.
Brilliant. Can I just again cheekily pick you up on something? This is something you mentioned in one episode. The word openly is no longer relevant, isn't it? In that bio.
True. So this was our pitch originally. This shows how with time your target audience moves, but it also is going to lead me to give an example of how by actually doing something and getting out there and having a very well-defined target and tagline, it actually helps you work out who your product is actually for. So When Feature Upvote, when we first created it, it was for us. I had another product, a consumer product, and we were overwhelmed, drowning in feedback, and I was trying to manage it in spreadsheets and Jira, and nothing really worked. So we created Feature Upvote for that. And the target audience was companies just like us, small bootstrap software companies up to five people or revenue of about 50,000 per month max. So I thought it was people who would want this open thing. Mm-hmm. But in the first 6 months, maybe 12 months, although we got some customers like that, we also got some customers that were so different to what we ever had in mind. For example, Heidelberg Cement, world's biggest cement conglomerate, became a customer and they're paying $29 per month. And JCB, the famous UK earth moving equipment company, were paying us $29 per month. And Schneider Electric, another big multinational, although originally German company. And these, I didn't even know how these people found us, but they also were not who we created the company for. So then we started looking to who in these companies were using us. And it turned out to be product managers. And we started listening to product managers. And then it turns out they often didn't want to open. They didn't want other people to be able to see the feature requests. They just wanted a place to store them and store who requested them, but not actually show that to the outside world, which led us to introduce what we call proxy voting or vote on behalf of, which actually became a core feature early on. It's one of those small features. They say adding features doesn't improve your revenue, but that was the one feature we added that basically opened up our product to a whole new field, was letting people, internal people, customer support and product managers and so on, add feature requests and votes on behalf of customers.
Well, that's amazing. And it's an amazing story because you're right. There are even jokes about and memes about, you know, a founder adding more features, hoping it will grow a product. But in your case, this one, but it came from listening to customers. It wasn't kind of your gut feeling, oh, let's add that, right?
And the whole product is about not going by gut feeling. The whole idea of Feature Upvote is you actually listen to what customers want. You find out what most people are asking for. Then you can multiply that by some weighting to work out, well, this feature gets a lot of votes, but it's actually going to be a pain in the neck to implement, whereas this other one is almost as popular, it's easy to implement and fits in with our vision. So let's do that. So it's our whole product is about gathering data and then using that data to make better product decisions. So if we're not doing that ourselves, then there's something really wrong with the way we're, we're running our company.
Something would be fundamentally wrong there, right? Now, we're talking here about growth, your growth. But before we get to that, I want to talk about two concepts, two kind of your maybe aspects of your business philosophy. And I think they shaped to probably, well, a great extent, your growth mindset. And they're very much interconnected. So we can talk about those two concepts in one go. One is the, I'm sure you've asked this all the time, but the low stress company, right? And the other one, it's the slow growth. You spoke and wrote a lot about it. And tell me about those. Let's start with the low stress, because most people, founders I talk to, they're actually overstressed. They all of them admit, oh, running a startup is like ridiculous. And it is. But you kind of found a way to maybe not combat it, but maybe minimize it. Actually, you should tell us about it, not me. So.
Okay, first, I do get stressed in my company, but I'm aware that that will happen and that I have to do things to minimize that and handle that, and that to some degree we can choose how much we want to embrace stress and what to what degree we want to ignore it. Look, I had a consultancy in my 20s, an IT consultancy, just after the dot-com boom, and that company did okay, never really made much money for me, but my staff were well paid, so that was something. And after a couple of years, and it wasn't actually intended to be a consultancy, it was intended to be a software company, but to get the money to build a software product, we did some consultancy, and that actually really took off. So I had a team of about 10 people, and I actually came to hate it. I hated it. Hated that my role as founder was now solely about sales and marketing, and I hardly ever got to do the work. I hated the fact that we only ever had about 3 months of work in the pipeline, which meant that, worst case scenarios, I was 3 months away from having to sack everybody, which kept me awake at night. And at the same time as this was happening, I started getting this really terrible lower back pain. And no matter what I did, I couldn't get rid of it. Exercising and going for massages and talking to doctors and lying down on the floor. Sometimes at work, I would just lie down on the floor for a while listening to some music, which my staff often thought was strange, but, you know, it's what I was trying to do. And nothing seemed to help. At the same time, I was also thinking, like, I need to get out of this business. It's not what I wanted. It's not what I want to be doing with the rest of my life. And I had taken on a business partner, the two business partners who owned a bit of the company. And I told them one day, hey, I want out. I want to be done in 3 months' time and travel the world. The next day, the back pain was gone.
Wow.
Now, that's was it amazing. Coincidence? I'm almost certain it wasn't. I'm almost certain that enduring lower back pain was completely tied to the stress of being in a company I didn't want to be in. And that has shaped me forever. Now I know that this is a physical manifestation that I will experience when I'm feeling stressed, that I don't like it, and that I have to be careful to choose a path that doesn't do this. So there's a lot of self-awareness that has shaped me towards this aiming for low stress. Okay, where am I in answering your question? I think I've kind of lost track of what I'm answering.
No, your answer. We're talking about the low stress, that ideology. Okay. So tell me, how does that work in practice at Future Upvote?
Okay.
Because there's one thing to be like, say, okay, we're going to run a low stress company, and then the business life happens, which is full of stress. So, tell me, how does that work?
Anybody who's had a full-time job, especially in knowledge industry, such as programming, coding, for example, you soon learn that you're not effective all day. You probably have 2 hours, three at most of the hours when you're really, really productive. A couple of hours in which you can kind of get some stuff done, but, you know, it's not when you're going to have your great ideas. And the rest of the day, you might as well not even be there, especially if you're trying to solve some coding problem. You actually often make it worse when you're really tired in those last couple of hours of the day and trying to solve it. So what's the logical thing to do? Is it to keep working more hours? No, it's to not do those last couple of hours. So I've embraced that, and I only worked between 3-4 hours per day, knowing that that's the best hours of the day. And it's not like I'm getting half the work done. The time that I'm not spending on the company was the time that wasn't going to be very productive anyway. And that's time for me to do the other things that are important in life, such as doing exercise, practicing the piano, a hobby of mine, playing computer games. I have to admit, I spend far too much time even today playing computer games. It was a lot more before my daughter was born. And working on other things, seeing friends, really catching up with friends, especially business owner friends during the day is a great stress relief. And really, really making myself switch off from the business and go and do something else altogether. Now, a few years ago, when my business was just, the current product, Feature Upvote, was just a year or two old, I was beginning to get this stressed feeling again. And then I had a bootstrappers lunch I went to. And I remember at the bootstrappers lunch, people were talking about how fast they were growing. And I said at the table how I aim to grow no more than 10%. Now, 10% is really fast growth if you're doing $1 million per year, 10% per month. But if you're doing less than 10K, well less than 10K at the time in monthly recurring revenue, not growing 10% per month doesn't make any sense. And I remember when I said it, I aim to keep growth below 10% per month. The table just went quiet.
Of course, that
scene you see in a movie where someone goes to the bar and orders a soda and the whole bar goes quiet. Yeah, it was like that. Yeah. And I don't think people really got it. They didn't really get where I was coming from because it's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to aim to grow as fast as possible.
Yeah.
Now, if you're growing at 10% per month, that means I think the compounding works out that after 8 months you've doubled and that in 1 year you've tripled. That means you're going to have triple the number of customers to support, triple the amount of web traffic to support, triple the amount of information in your database. It's actually really hard to be always having to deal with those scale problems, even at a bootstrapper level. And by aiming to grow slowly, we're still going to eventually end up with a sizable company, but we're not always in that firefighting mode, always having to think, how on earth can we fix the company? Because it's now three times as big as it was a year ago, and it's going to be three times as big in another year. So part of the low stress and low growth approach I have is saying I don't want to be in that stressful situation, always having to deal with problems. I want to be able to stick to my approach of only working 3 or 4 hours per day and having time for these other things in life.
I love it. I love it. But I can imagine how controversial it must have sounded. And on a funny thing, I'm being asked about my growth rate all the time. And, you know, I'm a solo consultant. It's just me by design. I don't want to grow. I don't want to have a business, as in grow the company into an agency. And so there is no growth rate. And I work on monthly contracts with clients, right? So there is no growth rate. And generally just have my schedule full for a couple of months ahead. And that's it. There is no space for anybody. So growth is never going to happen unless, you know, raising rates is the one thing. But it's not the same, right? The number of clients will always stay. Maybe it is to some degree. But yeah,
I have a question for you. Did you ever think about doubling your rates and working half the hours?
That's a very good question. Doubling your rates, my rate, yes. Working short hours. So here's the fun thing. That I'm already doing. So it's not about this. This show's about you, not me. So thank you very much for turning the table. Right? But hey, one thing. So my story is maybe not similar, slightly different. But I'm a trauma survivor from childhood. So I have. It's the first time I'm saying this. So this is big thing. But because of that, I also experienced like physical manifestations of stress. And I used to work idiotic hours like most founders or most business people until similar situations like you. So my body started telling me, look, there's something wrong. I can't cope with this and with other stuff, et cetera, et cetera. So I basically made a similar decision to you. It's not worth it. Life's somewhere else. And like with you, those, you know, certain physical manifestations reduced. I'm it's very hard to say. It's like, you know, you put me in a spotlight a bit, but it's a similar story. So I don't work crazy hours. Sometimes I do, actually, for explanation. Sometimes I do, but it's fun stuff like this show or something I'm building, but it's not client work. So I generally, like I said, there's no growth because I capped the number of clients I have deliberately. I don't want to grow this into a business. I tried. And again, stuff, the physical manifestations, even from my past, have started coming back. And I was like, nope, that's not for me. I'm not cut out for this, I suppose. So, yeah, that's to answer your question. I wasn't ready for it. So thank you so much for putting me in this. But
so
realistically...
It's revealing that you understand. You understand where I'm coming from. And I think you'll find a lot of people do. When a couple of us say, I've chosen not to do that because I know it has this effect on me for whatever reason, other people identify.
For me too. Yeah, for me too. I just realized, you know, I very quickly realized that, for instance, I don't want to be that one of the parents who are never at home. Like, I have two kids, right? Well, they're kids, they're children, actually almost adults now at this stage. But
the other ones are never at home, right?
They're gone. They don't talk to me anymore. But you know, like when you have small kids, somebody once told me, if you don't hear the story when you pick them up from school over there, you'll never hear the story. Yeah. If you come back in the evening and you're there. So I made this conscious decision as well, even based on kind of my past. So I said, no, I don't want to be that. And I don't want to be that person. I want to be there for my kids. So yeah, it was a conscious decision. It was also health related, but yeah. So another thing I'm being asked is like, why don't you turn this into an agency? I said, I don't want to have the burden of having people and having to manage and be responsible for other people's mortgages. As bad as it sounds, I'm sorry. It's just, you know, I prefer to work my hours. And then if my health is, you know, I have a tougher day, I just don't show up. You know,
exactly.
I'm very lucky. I don't work from home. This is my office in town, so I can just not show up, right? And I just set up an autoresponder. I learned this thing just to minimize the stress. A tip to minimize the stress, because you always worry somebody will email you, and you say, I need to check my email in case. But if you set up an autoresponder, I'm not in today. It kind of gives you like, you know, get out of jail free card. It's like, I'm not there. It's like, but you know, I told you, so it's fine.
That book from Tim Ferriss from long ago, The 4-Hour Work Week, the book felt to me like a bit of snake oil, but there was one thing I did like a lot in it was he talked about this not answering emails. I think he talked about exactly what you do, put on an autoresponder that tells people, thanks for writing, I check my emails twice a day at, I don't know, 8 a.m., 8 p.m., and I'll answer you then. And just almost training people not to expect him to reply straight away, but also make them understand that there's a reason he's not replying straight away. And this is something for a long time after reading his book I did. So I would only check emails twice a day. Somehow along the years, I went back into checking email every 5 minutes. I don't know why or how that happened.
We've all been there. I've checked my emails twice a day. Now it's a bit more. But I have a few other kind of systems, like, and I've had them for years. First of all, you know, like we have the Calendly booking link or whatever you use, right? But the calendar booking link. And I only have 2 2-hour windows for my on the kind of client booking. And I said, I've been doing it for, I don't know, a couple of years at least. And I thought, right, it's very easy to get, you know, open your calendar and then at 10 a.m. you have somebody says, oh, I need to talk to you about something, which often isn't that important, actually. Could be done via email or at a later stage, but that interrupts your day. That those, like you say, 4 or 5 hours. So I deliberately said, okay, it's Tuesday and Thursday from 3 to 5 p.m. I'm available, right, on my calendar. That's it. And like you said, it's not, I don't want to say training people, but getting them used to this. And people, it's funny thing, we fear making those changes in our business, right? We fear going and saying, oh, you know, I'm not going to be available. Everybody's available all the time, but I'm not going to be. But nobody minds.
The
nobody's ever come
to work with. The customers,
yeah,
want
the customers,
the ones that are good clients understand what you're doing and they're impressed.
They know, and they're never going to go. I've never heard somebody say, oh, you're not available 24/7 when I need you. No, never heard that. Just people respectfully booked, chose from those two. So fine. So, yeah. But anyway, we started talking about me, but we were meant to talk about you. So let's go back. And I want to do something. I don't know if you've done it before, but I want to look at your growth slightly differently, look at your history, how you've been growing Future Upvote. And so I want to compare. So this Future Upvote today, so it's May 24, right? And then there is Future Upvote 2017, 18. That's, you launched 2017, but let's give you a few months for building and ramp up time. So let's say 2018. Mm-hmm. How your growth in terms of what you're doing, like, differs? Like, how does it look like now, and what it was in? We can start in 2018. And what I'm really trying to do is see whether it changed, progressed, and, you know, it's or even compare, like, what you've been doing then and now.
So back in 2018, we were very much focused on bottom of funnel SEO content. So if somebody searches for feature request tracking or roadmap voting, or at the time our big competitor was User Voice, if they search for User Voice alternative, mm-hmm. we wanted to be ranking well for them. And that was how we got most of our early customers. In fact, mm-hmm. that's how we got most of our customers even today. And this worked out pretty well. At one point, I felt like we had completely tapped out that whole area. It couldn't work out any other good bottom of funnel content we could actually write. It seemed like all the ones that were actually going to deliver us a meaningful volume of traffic that was targeted worked. So then we started moving towards the so-called, well, more content marketing, still SEO. I wouldn't even call it top of funnel, but we started mm-hmm. creating a really broad amount of content, and we very quickly doubled our website traffic and so on. Had no effect on our signups, had no effect on new customers. And actually, we stuck at that for a year and a half, and it turned out, in my opinion, to be a complete failure. Mm-hmm. Not a failure in that you still have to try things to find out if they'll work, but it didn't work, and then we learned to stop doing that. Tied in at the same time was the mini SaaS crash that some people listening will be familiar with in very late 2022 into the early years of 2020, the early months of 2023, as funding for startups started drying up, a lot mm-hmm. of SaaS companies started tightening their expenses and cutting their expenditure on products like ours, and that affected us. Actually, we lost about 15% of our revenue quite quickly, and since then we've been stable. So to recap, we had a very steady, stable, almost linear growth. Mini SaaS crash happened. And since then, we've been, plateau is almost a negative word. I like to say in balance, in harmony. How's that?
Okay.
So now we're actually looking at new ways of getting customers. There's two things we've done.
Okay.
So first, in the light of the mini crash, we wanted to find out more about our customers, stuff we should have been doing all along, but we weren't doing. So we got in touch with every single customer who had agreed to get on a call. We got on a call with them and asked them about how they used us, what they were doing beforehand, how they found us, how they describe us to other people, and so on. Two key things came out of that. About 15% of our customers were actually computer games, video games companies, and not software companies and product managers and so on. Wow. And 15% of our customers, coincidentally, no, 15% of our customers heard about us by word of mouth. The 85%. Every single one described having done a search for bottom of funnel content, yeah. right? For a well-targeted Google search. Mm-hmm. The video games companies were more of our company than we realized, and they were all finding out about us by word of mouth.
Okay.
And that got me thinking, like, if they're finding out about us by word of mouth, what can we do to encourage that? What would happen if we actually targeted this market? So this was all happening early last year, early 2023. In mid 2023, I was going to the UK for a couple of weeks on holiday, and it seemed to coincide with a big video games conference in Brighton. Mm. So I found I could get a free ticket for one day if I only stuck to the expo. And I went along mm-hmm. to that curious just to see, just to have a look mm-hmm. what was going on, how people were selling, the size of it. The moment I got off the train in Brighton, that conference was everywhere. Every billboard had something to do with the games conference. Everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people I've seen had branded t-shirts to do with companies at the conference. And it was no problem finding the conference because there were just so many people. I get a bit overwhelmed when I walk into a crowded room, and that feeling was very intense when I got to that conference, just so many people all around. And since then, I've been really putting work into increasing our marketing towards computer games companies. Now, this is a work in progress, so we're now 10 months since that conference. And I'm preparing to go to 3 computer games conferences in the coming months.
Lovely.
I've prepared a whole lot of marketing material. I'm working on a slideshow. I've talked to a PR expert from a computer games company who's briefed me into the language they use and what they look for in our marketing material. So that's one thing we've done as a result of our revenue growth having stalled or hit a kind of a stable point. The other one is trying to do something different with the content marketing. Now, I've been looking around at what do our competitors do, and they all have the same bland, generic, SEO-driven content that kind of feels like it was written by an expert content writer, but somebody who has no knowledge of in depth of the thing they're actually writing about. Probably you're familiar with this problem, right? Yeah. It's actually really hard to find somebody who A, is really good at the thing you do, and B, is prepared to write for it on a budget you can afford, and C, can actually write it well.
Yes. Well, tell me about it.
Yeah. So you understand the problem. And do you remember that movie, There's Something About Mary? It's pretty old now, maybe 25 years old. And there was this scene in which protagonist, played by Ben Stiller, picks up a hitchhiker, and the hitchhiker is telling Ben Stiller's character about this business idea he has. It's the 7-minute abs, like, you know, the 8 minutes ab workshop or course or video course he's telling to Ben Stiller. Well, I'm doing the 7-minute abs. And he's just convinced this is a no-brainer, that it's brilliant, he's going to make lots of money. And then Ben Stiller's like looking a bit worried because the guy's obviously psychotic, and actually says to the guy, but couldn't somebody just come and do, say, 6-minute abs? Well, go see the movie. You want to see how it works out. But the guy, the hitchhiker, doesn't actually like this, and didn't actually realize like somebody could just pip him. This is what I see happening in SEO content, specifically with this guide we want to write for our own website, the SAS. What is it? A first time product manager's brief guide to product to feature prioritization. It's a mouthful. Mm-hmm. That's the subtitle. So we want to write this and have it on our website. All our competitors have it. And it's this crazy one-up game of one-upmanship. So somebody created one that had a guide that had, you know, 5 prioritization frameworks you should use. And somebody made one that was 7. And somebody went for 11 and 15 and 20. And now the top one is like 37 ways you can decide what feature to build next. This is helping nobody.
No.
If I have the problem that I need help to work out how to decide what to build next to my software, a choice of 37 options is not helping me, right?
No.
Right. So what can we do? What can we do about that? Now, you probably have some ideas because this is your forte, but I'll tell you what we've decided upon.
Yeah, go on.
Talk to the experts.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to the experts. So I've been interviewing people who run software companies about how they actually make these decisions. I've been talking to product manager coaches about how they do this and product management experts. And I've brought in a good writer, who doesn't understand product management, which is a target audience, but is very good at listening and learning and shaping. So I've sort of solved the problem, like how do you get somebody who's both an expert and a good writer? Yeah. Well, two people, work them together.
Two people, exactly.
Yeah. So already the draft we have on this guide we're working on, which is going to take us the rest of the year, is feeling so much better than what everybody else has. We're using stories. We're picking what professionals actually do use for frameworks and talking about them. We're using the words of the professionals. I've managed to find some people who have picked one option and then have realized it didn't work. And we're using words about why it didn't work. And we've got 3 companies we're hoping to interview and put their case studies into this about how they think about this. And what's happening here is I've already created some buzz in our target audience about this, because one of the product coaches I'm talking to, who's actually agreed to help review the book or the ebook or the material and put in a foreword, he's actually already discussing it amongst his peer group of experts.
Brilliant.
So the hope is that this will do a lot of our publicity for us rather than us trying to do it just by hoping Google shines upon us and hoping that people like our guide, because our guide has 53 frameworks as opposed to 37 frameworks.
Yeah. These things never work. That's true. Not even in Google. This is the fun part. Like, you know, if this content ranks, it's not because it's 53 versus 35. It's probably the other. But, you know, it's like, but you're absolutely right. It's sometimes it is that battle to outdo, which is ridiculous, And I love this idea. I know I wanted to ask about the book, and that is the book, right?
Because
that's how you've been building a buzz around it, calling it a book. Now, like you're saying, it might be something else, but that's a brilliant idea, honestly, because it immediately, and maybe that's not how you've planned it, but it immediately cuts out everybody else except your target audience in this.
Right.
There is no public big kind of, what I'm trying to say is it's not sexy. Like the general population will not be sharing this, will not get excited, but you don't care, right?
Yeah.
You don't care. It's, you only care that the people who is this is for will see it, and that's it.
Exactly. And is it an SEO play? It's not. We've definitely made that a non-goal.
No.
Our goal is not to rank above other people on similar guides.
Yeah.
Our goal is to make sure that this guide reaches the right people, distribution.
Yeah.
And it's really nice for me to hear that you already know about the book. It shows that my efforts to keep promoting it on LinkedIn before it's even
LinkedIn,
done.
Yes.
It's already getting people aware of it. And in fact, I met up with a friend for lunch a couple of weeks ago, and he said, "So tell me about the book." Like, what?
And you're like, what book?
I didn't even know you followed me on LinkedIn.
Yeah. No, that's where I heard about the book. And it's and you're actually, if I can appraise you a little, if you don't mind,
please.
I love how you promote it, or you're promoting it without actually promoting it. What I mean is, it's not like, you know, very often you see like people say, "Oh, the five things I would do if I was this are blah, 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 and get my book." Right. And then there's five more in the book. It's like, and I think it's the content creator way of promoting. Nothing bad with that. But you're doing it in a very kind of gentle way by sharing progress updates or talking about the, it's almost like you're talking about the creation of the book, not the book. It's almost like how this goes. It's amazing. And I mean, it's like, oh, Steve's doing a book. Okay. That's
there
new.
You go.
Right. There you go. It's like, but you're talking about working on like how, what the process and what it's like. And like, so it's not really about the book, but it actually, like you say, people know about the book now.
It's LinkedIn is really good for this. LinkedIn is ephemeral. What I write on LinkedIn today, you might remember that I wrote something on LinkedIn, but you won't actually remember what I wrote in a week or two's time. Mm-hmm. So it's a great chance to try and formulate your ideas in a written form and see if they actually make sense and if people react to them. And this is actually some of the draft material for the book. This is the process. I don't say, hey, this is a draft chapter or a draft intro or whatever. We just put it there and see what people write. And just the process of writing it is helping improve the ideas.
Brilliant.
And every time I put something on LinkedIn, if it kind of, I feel like it's hit the mark, I then copy it to our Notion area we're using for the book and tell my writer, hey, here's some more material that you might want to use
this
time.
It's brilliant. And you say the deadline, like you said, the timeline is the end of the year, right? That's when you're...
There's no deadline. That's part of my low-stress approach to life.
Okay, fair enough.
Set these very artificial deadlines and all they do is create stress. And, you know, if you don't hit it, what does it matter? What does it matter if it takes an extra month? It doesn't, especially once you've embraced the fact that you're happy to grow slowly.
Yeah.
Hey, last night, absolutely. My daughter has this ongoing health problem related to eczema, and it really flared up last night at like 2 o'clock in the morning, 1 o'clock. So for a couple of hours, we were all awake while she was crying and so on. Really ruined the night. And as I got up this morning, I was thinking, oh, maybe I should ask Pavel if I can postpone this interview.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know what? The day's my own, and once this is done, if I want to just take the rest of the day off, I can. And I was thinking how hard it must be if people embrace that work hard, work hard, work hard. And they already have a calendar full of things and they're racing around.
I know.
And there's something actually better about adopting the low stress approach to work and working less hours. It means that when something unexpected happens, you can embrace it. You don't need to, it doesn't ruin everything. You don't have to cancel 10 plans or whatever. It's just like, well, I'm just going to move my day around a little bit. Things will still happen. Nothing's really lost. So I went back to that. I know that was an earlier discussion, but I wanted to mention this about the book. It's also of the book. If I set some deadline we have to reach, and then, I don't know, I get sick, my writer gets sick, or something bad happens in the company or good happens in the company and it needs a lot of focus, I don't feel bad about the fact that I haven't hit this artificial deadline.
Yeah, I totally understand this. Do the same thing. I know it's sort of a bad thing to plan your week fully, like hours or time block, etc. But and I tried that and I realized that was generating stress, not the actual what I was doing, but like, oh, I have only till noon to do this. And it's, you know, 11:30 and I'm still, and damn, I have another task lined up for this. No, I totally agree with this. It's, but do you find that it's the we live in, and maybe this is changing, but at least startup world used to be about the exact opposite. You're almost like it was a badge of honor that you reply to emails at 2 a.m., that you're always hitting deadlines, that you're always having your, you know, calendar full and your to-do list full, etc., etc. And I don't know, it's I for a long time, because I told you my story, I haven't been kind of working like what normally people do when they work. So, you know, they have their full long days, etc., etc. I still do sometimes, you know, because if I feel like it, I can stay longer, etc. And I'm also working on this show, etc. But anyway, but I felt like an outcast for a long time, even by having these weird approaches to work. Like, for instance, one of the approaches if we can talk more about this, I embraced, but gosh, years ago, we're talking 2015, something you said, when you reach out to, like, as a potential client to me, you don't talk to me until almost the last moment. So I almost like automated my sales process because, you know, a lot of the time, You get inquiries from people who are not a good fit or their goals don't align with what I can do, or there's no budget or millions of other things. And you sit on these calls and these, you know, people love to chat about themselves. I'm doing it now, for instance, and stealing your show pretty much, right? And I realized I don't want to be doing this. I'm happy to speak to somebody when they've almost like raised their hand and say, I'm a good fit and I'm ticking all the boxes. So one of the things I instilled and this is not my idea. I heard it from somebody, I don't remember the name, but the first product I service guy was like, I think his product was called Draft Revise. I don't remember his name, but he used to say, when you're applying, you're getting a PDF overview of the entire service. And if you're okay with everything, there's a link at the kind of brilliant. So I started doing the same thing. And now when you apply to me, I'll reply, send you my intro pack with all the information, including the rates, everything, and a Calendly link. So if everything's okay, schedule a call. But now you're qualified. And we actually don't have to do the normal sales call. The intro pack has done it, right? And we're just chatting the project because everything else is. And that cut out so much time. Like, you know, that just freed so much time in my schedule. So, yeah, I understand that. And same thing with deadlines. And, well, I obviously have deadlines for clients, and that's unavoidable. But even like one of my clients once said, like, why are you worrying about deadlines? It doesn't matter if that guide goes or if that page, we launch it today or tomorrow. It's like, it's easy for you to say because you're the client. It's not that easy for me to say, right?
Yeah. But you have to keep telling yourself, I think, I have to keep telling myself, that's for sure, this is not so important. It's not so important if we get this feature released on time. It's not so important if we get this new piece of content out on time. It's not so important if I don't go to that thing I wanted to go to, that event, meetup event that's really good for my product. You have to keep reminding yourself, because if you don't, it can be very easy. Well, if I don't, it can be very easy to start falling into what we think we should be doing.
Yes,
so
you do.
Two things I wanted to say. First of all, I'm in Barcelona. It's quite warm today, even though it's May. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there's a building outside where they're stripping out all the asbestos, so I have to keep the door closed, which is making my glasses fog up, which is why I keep having to take them off.
That's all right.
It's actually driving me a bit batty, but I'm doing my best to keep concentrating on what we're talking about. Now, you mentioned about people, like the default approach, or is that we have to be really stressed and work hard and hustle.
Yeah,
I think this is the impression you get if you watch how businesses portrayed on TV and movies, TV shows and so on. It's also the impression you get if you follow people, too many people or the wrong people on Twitter, where they're forever talking about all this work hard stuff. The reality is a lot of people have realized that life needs a balance, but they're not the ones talking about it all day on Twitter because they have balance in their life, right? They've realized that social media is actually not very healthy. So you get a very, very warped view. And if you find ways to tune into what people are saying in other places, you actually realize it's really, really common that people in our situation, you and me, we take our kids to school, we pick them up from school, we take time off when they're sick, we take time out in the day to exercise, we don't work much in summer because we've got kids to look after, we find ourselves, we try to make ourselves accept our revenue as it is, or we have very modest aims for growth. I think you'll find this is really, really common if you just look in the right places and stop looking in the wrong places, which is people bragging on Twitter.
I'm totally innocent. I'm not on social media apart from LinkedIn, so I don't know what they're saying there anymore. But I'll give you an example. Years ago, I was still working as an SEO for a company, and I was building slowly my business, and I would automate the hell out of my Twitter. I was using Twitter back then. And I remember at some stage, somebody sent me a comment, "Do you ever sleep? Because your post..." And I was like, does he not realize I can schedule this? That this is the early days of Buffer, or I don't know if it was even Buffer. I used something else, but whatever, right? I think it was back then, it was some desktop scheduler even, like, you know, very early days. But do you not realize I'm just scheduling it ahead of time and I'm not even there? Right?
Why would they realize? Like,
they wouldn't know. True. Yeah, exactly.
The default on Twitter is someone's actually written this on the spur of the moment and clicked post.
And it gave them the impression I never sleep. And it was like, do you ever sleep? I said, yes, I'm not even that often on Twitter. But it was like, it was so funny. So when you're saying this, it reminded me, I got that comment once years and years ago.
Even Jason Cohen, who I admire a lot and has a lot to teach us all about startups, he also says this line that, you know, in the early days of a startup, it has to be, you have to work crazy hours, which I do not agree with at all. And I've seen some people disagree with them publicly on that, some successful people. So it just shows how easy it can be to hear that message and to think it's what you have to do. Absolutely not true. Absolutely not true.
I'm glad to hear that. And I love that approach you're taking, like slow growth. It's still growth. It's we're not setting up this 10-20% growth target every month and then stressing over it and, you know, going crazy and then not hitting it and stressing even more. Because I think what you once said that in your early days, your growth was actually something like 20%. I know. Yeah. It's on your side. And there's I'll quote it. And you said, I think this is the only time I'm sharing our MRR graph because it will never be again like that again, because it was just early days. So a move from one customer to two is doubling your customer base.
Exactly,
it sounds so great, right? But move from two to three is no longer doubling, right? You know, move from 20 to 22 is completely different percentage wise. It just changes. And you said, I remember this saying, I think this is the last time I'm publishing a graph like this because it'll never happen again.
Exactly. I think, yeah, I don't remember the exact numbers and I definitely didn't share them at the time, but I think maybe we went from $1,000 per month to $1,200. You know, I think it was that kind of level. Maybe we got $300 in new business and lost $100. And at our current pricing point, $300 is three new customers, right?
Yes.
It's not much.
So
I think this is also something on Twitter. You see people bragging about how they're growing at a 50% or 100%. But, you know, did they go from one customer to two customers, two customers to three customers? That's not 50% growth. Sure, mathematically, strictly it is. But it's not what people think of when they say 50% growth. They're thinking you're going from a million to a million and a half.
Yes, I have the same problem in SEO. When you see a lot of case studies, and I'm not really calling anybody out, but you say, oh, we grew this startup's traffic by 100% in 6 months. Great, but they had zero traffic. Now they have, I don't know, or five visits a month. Now they have 50. So yes, the percentage-wise, it's magnificent. But when you actually look at the numbers, it's not. So I'm always saying to people, beware of these percentages. It's easy to say, oh, we grew it by 7,000%. Yes, because they have two visitors and now they have, 300 or whatever.
Show me the real number. Show me the absolute numbers and then I'll be impressed. So I like that you've already familiar with my now more or less discontinued podcast and some of the stuff I've written in the past. It shows that you have discovered that there are people with this low stress approach who aim for low stress even if they don't always achieve it. And, you know, there's others I'm sure you would have encountered in this world around that. I've had them on the podcast. Andy Bryce, for a long time, has been my role model. He always said, I don't want employees. Like, I don't want that. All I want is my business to be a one-person business. And I don't aim for anything higher. And I meet up with Andy whenever I can because it's just so refreshing to hear him talk about
it. It is, and from my point of view, it's very stressful actually to say that. Say, oh no, I just want to be one person business. I actually went as far now as moved the domain from, I used to have like a brand name to just my name. Because I used to call my company an agency because for a long time I realized that the startup market doesn't really want to, it doesn't really look for consultants. They mostly think agencies. Okay. But it was bothering me. It was like for a year of that, it was like really bugging me, that label agency. And I knew from business perspective, from like every advice you get is like, this is the right label. And then I went like, oh no, pardon my French, but sod it. I'm calling myself what I am, a solo consultant. And then the brand made no sense having the brand there. So I just said, okay, I'm going. And I owned my name as a domain with my name. So I just moved back to this. And I said, that's it. And I got an email from somebody saying, why did you change? Exactly why. I know from business perspective, it's probably a wrong decision. But for me, my sanity, the stress levels, it's the right one. And
I got to say, not only was it 100% the right decision, you should write this on your site in the, I don't know if you've done it already, in the About Me, the About Pavel page. It should say, I did this because of this reasons. And this will get you the right customer. And people will read the story and they like it. We get customers because they read our About page about why we deliberately run the business as a low-stress zone. And they connect to this. And they say, I like this. Yeah. I have got customers because they've liked that. Second, when I'm dealing with people to help me with specific tasks, I much prefer working with our one-person shows than agencies because I know the person I'm talking to is the person – they're either directly doing the work or they're directly managing every aspect of it because it's their reputation on the line. So this is a selling point. This is good.
It is a selling point.
100% the right point. If this is what you're doing, tell people it's the way you're doing things.
Appreciate it.
Make that into an asset, a selling point.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. It's like I said, it was bugging me, the label agency, for years. I've been doing this since 2010, right? And bugging me, just like agency, it just doesn't click with me. And so he said, sod it. It's not worth it. Like the stress is not worth it, you know? Yeah. But anyway, I'll jump elsewhere because it starts becoming about me and it should be about you. So I'll turn
people
it
around. People want to hear about you too, Pavel.
Thank you so people much. Appreciate it. Slowly, slowly over time, revealing, you know, myself to the world. But I tell you something, I'm going to do something you said you're always afraid of on your show. So one time
spiders?
You said,
"Is it being trapped in a box?"
No, no spiders, no bugs, no. It's something related to your point. So you said on one episode, you said that one of your like great fears in podcasting and marketing is that somebody will go back, listen to all your shows, you know, and will find contradictions and will actually call you heaven. Now I'm not going to go that far. But I noticed something. Some things they're interesting. They're not contradictions. Don't worry. It's not that far. It's like, oh, in episode 107, you said yes to this, and in one, just 211. No, we're not gonna go there. But in one of the episodes, you were kind of describing your approach to growing feature upvote, and you said that for you, the kind of key thing is to first of all have the same amount of customers roughly every month, because that's then you're steady, the business is kind of steady and safe. Mm-hmm. And then obviously slowly grow. And you used to have it on my other screen. I used a wonderful term to describe it, and I want to kind of hear more about it, because you said repeatable sales channels. And now, obviously, the term itself is self-explanatory, but I want to hear it from you, because it's an incredible concept. Like when you say, okay, I just need to find, I'm guessing that's how you approach it, like 2-3 repeatable channels and use them as a foundation and just carry on with them until they've stopped working. Am I right in thinking about it? Like, because you didn't explain the term. You just used this term, repeatable sales channels, for a start. It's like, wow, this just sounds incredible. That's like, it should be TM afterwards, trademarked.
Okay, chances are I just read somebody else use the term before.
Fair enough.
I don't remember saying it myself, but I understand what I was thinking. This is exactly what you have to do when you're, especially if you're just getting started. People think the launch is, a lot of people think if they've never run a business before, if they've never run a SaaS or a software product before, they think what they have to do is create a product that's beautiful. People love to use the word beautiful to describe software. Hint, your audience, your customers don't use the word beautiful to describe it, and they don't care that anybody thinks it's beautiful. They care that it solves a problem. They care that it helps them get their job done. Okay, that was an aside. So people think they make the product, and then they do a launch on Product Hunt or whatever other platform it is today, AppSumo, and that's it. They're done. This is not repeatable. This is a disaster if this is all you've thought about in the way you're going to sell your product. You need to find something that is repeatable, that this today, tomorrow, next month, the month after, next year will still work. And this is why person after person discovers that SEO, and for good or bad, is what they have to do, because it puts that content on there on your website that people are going to keep finding day after day via Google or whatever search engine they're using. Even ChatGPT is working for me now, believe it or not, as a source of customers, and it's based on the content we've written. And if you keep, once you've got a whole bunch of content that's the right content on your site, it will keep working and getting people to discover your website, discover your product, sign up for a trial, convert from trial to paid. There's a lot of covered, I've glossed over, such as the whole onboarding experience and the way you describe your product on your website, but that is a repeatable sales process. And after a while, it's not that it will stop working, but you'll reach the limits of what that can do. And I believe we hit that.
Yes.
Same with, going for ads. Google Ads is the big one, although there's other ways of doing ads. At first, it won't work, and you'll talk to an expert, and you'll tune what you do, and you'll try and try. And for us, it never worked. For some people, it will eventually work. Right, once it's working, keep repeating it. Keep putting in the money each month. Put in more money if you can, but at some point, you also find that you hit a point where it's no longer profitable to put in additional money.
Yeah.
But if it works for you when you're putting $1,000 or $2,000 per month, $5,000 even if you're feeling rich, then that will keep working for you month after month. Of course, everything has an ultimate point in which it no longer works, because the world is dynamic and keeps changing. But this is what I mean. Just work on finding that thing that's going to keep working month after month.
I love it.
Yeah. Your business will never be able to be like an autopilot. That's also a myth people have, especially SaaS. It's never...
Yes.
What's the word they use? A business that runs itself? Passive income. No such
passive
thing
income,
as passive income in the world of SaaS. But once you find the right channel that's working, it will become a lot easier to run the business.
Yeah, I agree. And I particularly love you're saying, like, the channel will not stop working, but you may stop working on it, right? Yeah. Like you mentioned with SEO. It's funny how one of the toughest conversations I have with clients are about stopping. So, like, for instance, content production. exactly the situation you've described. We've covered everything that's going to bring money. Yes, we can start writing about anything, but it's just an exercise in, I don't know what, it's like wasting server space with this content, yeah. Really, right? It's, so there is a moment when you need to say, okay, that's it, stop. It doesn't mean you're done, but it means your actual production or your activities moved from to improving. Exactly. Which is just taking this and seeing, oh, can I get more out of this? And it doesn't necessarily mean, oh, we're going to just go and increase rankings. Maybe we're already ranking on top, or the traffic we're getting is phenomenal. It's fine. Of course, if we get more, it'd be better. But actually looking at, can we convert more people on these pages, etc. And you won't believe it how tough this is to explain. Yeah. You'd think, oh, it's obvious. Okay, we've reached that stage. Now let's just get more from what we have. No, people just want to say, okay, let's keep on doing. It's almost like this is the tangible justification of doing SEO. We're just adding. And it's like, we don't have to add. But we've reached that point where we've covered the content, this channel. Now we're improved. Right. And I'm glad you're mentioning this, and I'm glad to hear your experience. Like, you've experienced that firsthand, right?
I suspect that every single person listening to this podcast or watching us who has a product, has a website with content, if you go into Google Search Console or whatever you're using for analytics, I suspect there's 10 pages max that accounts for 98% of all your traffic.
Yes. Yes.
Of all your organic traffic. Yes. And like, there's a reality. Maybe you've got 200, 300, 500, 1,000 pieces of content, and most of it's just doing nothing. And so I completely agree with you. You've wasted your time. However, how did you find out which are the right 10 pieces? You do have to write a lot. But then once you've discovered it, exactly what you said, keep improving those, or even say, what we've done here is pretty good. We can reduce our efforts here and go and try another channel, which in my case, I'm now trying the selling to games, which is a whole new discovery process.
Exactly. Try something new. And it's, I totally agree. And I know I'm saying, I'm being an SEO consultant, I should be saying, no, you do it forever.
Yeah.
But no, there is, especially with startups, there is a point where you just have to say, not I'm done, but the actual building it up is done. So we can scale, improve, try something else. No, I absolutely agree. And I actually appreciate having those conversations with clients when they say, are we done? Yes, we are. But most of the time, what I'm saying is, like, it's very hard to invent work for yourself, to be inventing. It's easier for me. And it's actually, I'm prefer to say, look, I'm done. I can try take it to the next level. And there's a lot we can do. But in terms of building it up, we're done. There's no point adding, because we're adding pages that are not going to contribute much. That's the really top of the funnel. It's probably different for, and I'm saying probably deliberately because I haven't experienced that, for like these super massive large companies like HubSpots of the world, because they just turn content all the time and, you know, they can do whatever they want. That's a volume game at this stage.
But they have such great distribution channels. People read their content, even the mediocre stuff, because of their really effective distribution
brand,
channels that people like you and I can't do. We're bootstrappers.
No, we can't.
My company at its peak is just a few people. What can we do?
Yes, exactly.
So there's this marketer who does run an agency, Corey Haynes. You might be familiar with him. He did have a podcast, which was like marketing for SaaS or something. Mm-hmm. I forget what it was called exactly. In one of his interviews, he talked to somebody who only had 10 pieces of content on the website, mm-hmm. who actually embraced that idea so much that just said, I'm only having 10 and I'm going to keep making sure they rank number one for the target keywords, and that's it.
Yeah.
Which I really liked that. It made me want to go and delete half my website, actually.
And you know, sometimes that actually works when you delete it. That's another tough conversation I have.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Sometimes, like, especially if I work, this is a tough conversation, if I work with companies that come to me with body of work, and half of it is really bad. Like, I mean, not only does nothing in terms of traffic rankings, etc., and conversions, it's poorly written. It's clearly written by not by an expert. So it's generic to the core. It actually sends the wrong message in terms of your authority, etc. And it's a tough conversation. We might actually be better off just, you know, removing those. on this show, I think 2 weeks ago, I published a show with a former client of mine, Wise Pops, now with their current head of growth. And he talked about how they dumped 50% of content on the site. And that had actually enormous effect on their performance. Because that kind of said that there was a time when they were accepting guest posts, and obviously they weren't the best content. They just had this idea, let's get as much content in and build the... And I can clearly say it about this because it's public. They said the same thing on the show. Okay. So, right, this is public knowledge now. And they said, okay, they were accepting guest posts, etc. And eventually they realized this is working against them. So they just pruned it, like... I think it's like 51%, he said. Oh, no. Awesome. Well, it's easy to look
really
up on the show.
To be the same.
But
do we have time for one last story I can tell on a related
note? Yeah, sure. Yeah, we have time. Yeah, sure.
So I mentioned that we tried doing this really broad content where we were finding keywords where we could rank easily, that we had a big volume and get a lot of people to the site. Things that weren't really a perfect match for our product, but it was kind of tangential.
Yeah.
And it really worked. We were getting lots of people to come and download our free templates and go and see our page where we're joining the argument of what's a bug versus what's a feature request and so on.
Yeah.
Our competitors started noticing that we were ranking well for this. I don't know, they were using Ahrefs or whatever tool. And our more switched on competitors went and tried to write the same pages, but better than us. The whole like I said with the... you know, we're going to do more frameworks in our article. So we're going to write the same article, but we're going to do it better. And I could tell that they had started from my article because I have a certain distinctive way of writing, or the writer I was using has a certain distinctive way. And I could see certain elements just there present. It's like, oh, yeah, they've obviously just, you know, taken our article and then tried to rewrite it and added things. And then they started outranking us. And actually... even though we were still doing quite well on those pieces of content, I took them down off the site. I took maybe our four or five top sources of traffic off our website because it was disguising, it was giving us a false illusion that we were doing well with SEO, and it was hiding what was happening to our important pages. When something's getting 1,000 visits, but it's doing nothing, then the page that used to get 100 visits wasn't important, but went down to 50. You don't notice that.
Right. Yes,
in the stats. So I just took off all these big ones. And the irony is that several of our competitors put so much work trying to copy what we were doing with something that we know failed. And great, now they feel good. They feel like their content team has had success, but I know they haven't. Unless they found some magical way to convert non-targeted audience traffic to buy their product, which you don't get.
Random
strangers
to
buy a B2B SaaS product.
Yeah. I love this because it shows something you've actually mentioned before on this show and many times over, is listening to your audience, right? And being very targeted. Because clearly, from what you're saying, your competitors went in to Ahrefs and either analyzed or whatever other platform, analyzed your domain and said, this page is driving the most traffic, et cetera. So just say, let's do the same thing, but better or improve it or whatever, right? They may have ranked for other reasons than the fact that they had more frameworks. Their authority might have been better. It's different times at play, right? And so they having even fewer frameworks than you, they might have helped them to rank. So we're leaving that aside, right? But they basically, or they went and, you know, look at the keywords and say, Feature Upload is doing there. It's like, we have to do this too. But without actually possibly considering, does that actually could have any impact on our brand, right? Yeah. It's just a numbers game then. Oh, we've added 10 more pages. Great. Yeah. You know, it's like success.
So our traffic is a fraction of what it was at the beginning of the year. There was a conscious decision. And, you know, people might look into my company from outside and think, oh, Steve's got it all worked out. He knows what he's doing. Truth is, like, floundering and just guessing and trying things. And it's a good reminder that this is also with your competitors. When you look at what they're doing, you think they're polished, you think they know what they're doing. Yes. They're not. They're desperately trying to find content that works by looking at what's happening.
Everyone around,
They're misinterpreting. They're making the wrong assumption that we've got it all worked out. And I just think this is hilarious. And it's a good reminder to me that nobody knows what they're doing. No matter how much of a polished image they give with all the right answers. We're all like just struggling, trying to find the right ways to sell our products.
Yeah. And generally, if we find, we don't talk like openly about this, right? It's like
one of the reasons why I stopped podcasting on my own podcast, because whenever I talked about something I was doing that was working, my competitors would start doing it the following week.
Okay, fair enough. Well, yeah, that's it's funny. You're not the first one to mention something like that on this show, so it's quite funny. But I had one guest who were like openly just embracing it and laughing about this and just saying, I'd let them copy. They'll never do it as good as me because I'm doing it based on my experience. So it's fine. But anyway, listen, this has been a fantastic chat. I still have a number of questions, but we've already gone an hour. So I'll let you go. You had a tough night. But I'm going to finish our conversation, especially when we talked about our businesses, with a quote I found. It's not your quote, but you quoted it. And I think it sums up the low stress, slow growth. I don't know if you remember this quote is by Bob Dylan. And the quote goes, a man is a success if he gets up in the morning and goes to bed at night and in between does what he wants to do.
Thank you to my friend Andy Bryce, who has that quote on his website.
I think
that's exactly where I got it from. And I think it's fantastic. And it's a good reminder to myself reading that quote and hearing it said back to me again. It's a good reminder to myself that this is basically my life. So I should consider myself a success. And the same to anybody watching or listening. If this is what you get to do, if you get to wake up in the morning, go to bed at night and choose what to do in between, you're a success. And I'm happy that you're a success.
Yeah, there is another book that was very kind of fundamental in shaping my view on this. It's called The Strangest Secret in the World. And it's, I think it was Earl Nightingale. I don't remember who wrote it. But basically the premise is like we become what we think about. And he says the definition of a success in our society is wrong, because the definition of a success is, you know, wealth, private jet, blah, blah, blah. Although he wrote it like in, I think it's in late 40s. And but anyway, like, you know, whatever was equivalent of massive success back then. But he said, if somebody wants to be a primary teacher and that's what they become, they're a success because they defined it. So we define our success. It's like you say, it's a fabulous piece of advice. It's not what Twitter tells us, right? You've mentioned that. It's what we tell ourselves. If you have a one-person consulting business and we're absolutely happy with it because we can spend time with the family, etc. Hey, you know.
Pavel, you have to tell that story more often.
I will.
You've chosen this path. Yeah, people want to hear it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for facilitating me to tell it on my own podcast about you, in the episode about you. This is so fantastic. It's been so great to be put in the spotlight and not planning on being in the spotlight. But here we are. That was fantastic. Note to self, be careful when you're inviting Steve to your show. He might turn it all about you.
But in a way that's interesting to everybody listening.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. That was so kind. Listen, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Thank you so much. Cheers, man.
Take care. Bye.